Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Amy.
We are here for a special Blogging Heads. I'm Amy Sullivan, and I'm a contributing writer with Time Magazine.
And I'm Catherine Mengi Ward. I'm a senior editor at Reason Magazine.
Well, good to be talking with you for the first time here, Catherine. And congratulations on your 6 weeks old.
Thank you very much.
This is a big accomplishment, and an even bigger accomplishment to be moving back into Blogging Heads.
Right. Well, that is a major milestone. It's actually in the baby development books, I think. You know, first Smile, and then shortly thereafter, first Blogging Heads. But
I think you're right.
This is something you know, since you are the mother of just a slightly older child. So.
I'm glad you're hitting the milestones there. That's important.
Yeah. Semi-mommy themed Blogging Heads, but really it's going to be Donald Trump themed, right? Because that's what truly matters in life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe before we jump into the weirdness that is Donald Trump and presidential politics, we can deal with the shutdown that wasn't. Which was obviously the big news dominating the end of last week. So today, date us, but this week we have federal workers going to work as normal, but that was not actually necessarily in the cards last week until there was a deal struck at apparently the last moment on Friday night. What do you think of the deal?
You know, as a long-standing procrastinator, I do have to say it made me feel a little bit better somehow about my own work habits that even the most accomplished statesmen in our nation can't get their work done until 11 p.m. when it's due at midnight. Also, but
The stakes are rarely that high when we're filing a piece.
Yeah, but also as a procrastinator, I know that when you get something done an hour before it's actually due, it's not very good, and I suspect that's what's going to happen here. There's been these sort of discussions about how there are still some details to be hammered out that because they didn't have time to do a full official budget resolution. They just did a kind of little temporary measure to keep things rolling. So,
right. A few minor details, like what actually are these cuts?
Right. For instance,
I kept asking my husband on Friday night, have I missed something or have they not actually determined where these cuts are coming from? Because that seems kind of crucial if you're going to sign on to this, particularly if you're a Democrat, to know where the cuts are coming from. It's kind of a leap of faith.
Boldly made it all the way to the end of the Times story that came out, late, right as the deal was being cut, because I was looking for the cuts. I was looking for the two sides have agreed to X dollars out of Y program. And, it wasn't in there that evening. And I thought, okay, well, they had to rush to get this up. They might not have the details. But in the subsequent coverage, I haven't seen a totally clear analysis of what's really being cut, and I think we probably have a little bit of trouble ahead from that perspective.
They're scrambling right now in the administration to actually comb through and find the cuts to meet that dollar amount.
Yeah, but it's in a way it's actually. We recently published in Reason Magazine, or maybe are about to publish, an excerpt from a very good new book about by Daniel Asked called "We Are the Enemy" or something like that, and it's about how you can pre-commit yourself to do things that you don't want to do, right? So he talks about this website where you can go sign up and you put a certain amount of money toward a charitable cause. If you either do meet your goals, that money goes to the charitable cause, or you could, for instance, pledge a bunch of money to the Nazi party unless you lose 20 pounds. And so that motivates you to meet your goals by sort of before you even begin locking yourself in. And I think in a way that's what this number is, this budget number. It's almost aspirational. They're just saying, okay, we promise to cut this number of dollars, and if we say it in public really loud a lot of times, it will be much harder for us not to cut it later on. Whereas mm-hmm. if we say it in private, the number can always be changed.
Well, and the number always did change in the lead up to the actual deal last
yes.
week. I mean, it's interesting you bring up that issue of committing yourself to something before you actually do it, because that was part of the White House's, I don't even know if it was a strategy, but it was part of their approach that kind of confused me last week, because you would think in a negotiation you want to be taken seriously not be in the position to have people call your bluff. And yet a number of times they were in the position of saying, you know, we'll go up to $20 billion in cuts and not a penny more. And then a few days later it was, okay, $32 billion in cuts, but not a penny more.
Right.
And obviously they ended up at even more than that. And that doesn't seem like the smartest approach to let the people you're negotiating with know that your final line in the sand is not actually your final line in the sand.
Right.
And I think it's significant because they've got even more and you know, amazingly more high stakes negotiations coming up. And I don't think that puts the White House in a very strong position, which is a turnaround for them because they started this whole negotiation from a position of strength, I think, that they have managed to completely lose, which is a feat.
Yeah. Well, and there's also, I think, you know, it's like walking into an auction house and announcing what your true reserve price is right off the bat.
You just
don't do it. It doesn't make sense as a negotiating yeah. tactic. But I wonder if the White House actually was trying to take advantage of the same phenomenon that, you know, that the Republicans were using of, you know, if they make this number public, if they make this number hugely public, that somehow does give it more power. It sort of gives it a talismanic force. And of course, as you quite rightly point out, the risk that they ran and the risk that they ultimately ended up having to bear was that they would, their bluff would be called and they'd have to back off the number. So,
mm-hmm.
I think they did not manage to use that phenomenon to their advantage.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I do wonder going forward what the consequences of last week are going to end up being, not just for Obama kind of across the board, but particularly with the base, because I think there are a lot of unhappy people out there who feel like he gave away the store, and he didn't give away the store because his back was up against a wall. He did it for reasons that are unclear to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think has come out through all of this is, you know, he spent a lot of 2008 talking about bringing civility back into politics and wanting to get rid of partisanship. And that's something a lot of people talk about. But it seems to be almost a fetish with him, that it's so important that it trumps everything else, because that seems to have been his guiding motivator in this last negotiation, was to be seen as the mature adult. When actually, politically, you could make an argument that he would have benefited if there was a shutdown. People would have been much more likely to blame congressional Republicans or just blame Congress in general,
right.
and kind of leave him largely out of it. But he wanted to be the one who was above it all and brought everybody together. At the expense, you could argue, of the economy, taking all of this money out of the economy may make it much harder for the recovery to actually continue, if you think it's continuing at all. And I'm not sure he's getting any credit from voters for that. It's hard to think of a single voter who, when they go to the polls in 2012, says, well, I really like that Obama because he seems like an adult in all the negotiations. I mean, looking at the Republican field right now, he's either so much more obviously normal than some of the candidates in the field, Or if he's up against a Romney or a Pawlenty, they're not crazy. And so, again, I don't think you get credit from voters for looking like an adult when they kind of look like adults, too.
I must say,
what was your take of him?
Yeah, I mean, I'm skeptical of any explanation of a political dynamic where one of the parties is was just being too nice or was just being too reasonable. And, you know, I think it's almost always a sort of safer and more accurate explanation to say, you know, everybody was playing their own kind of hardball. It's just that someone miscalculated. While I actually agree with you that the net result has been that Obama continues to kind of broadcast this I'm a reasonable guy persona, and I actually disagree with you. I think while maybe this particular incident won't be in people's minds, one thing that people have always liked about Obama and one thing that people do say to themselves when they go into vote on election day is, he seems like a nice, reasonable guy. He seems like
right.
a guy who won.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I guess it's the flip side of had he held his ground and forced the shutdown, I'm not sure
right.
he would have gotten blamed for that.
And as a native Washingtonian, or I grew up in the Washington area, one of my very earliest political memories is exactly how it went down when a shutdown actually occurred in the 90s. I have this memory of kind of this citywide grown-up snow day feeling that happened in the D.C. area when the government shut down. Mm-hmm. And also the anger at Congress, exactly as you say, that people did not perceive it in the end as something that the executive was to be blamed for, although, of course, that continues to be – the narrative of that continues to be fought out mm-hmm. even today. But I think we do have this kind of alternate history that's available to us of, well, what is it like if the shutdown really happens and who gets the blame? It was Newt Gingrich. It was those crazy Republicans in Congress. And it does seem like the dynamic now could have been very similar, could have been seen as very similar. So, I agree with you that the shutdown probably doesn't land on Obama's head, but I also think that his decision to be a reasonable guy and go for some cuts, maybe was a little bit more hard boiled than it might seem.
Right. Fair enough.
But then we also have now, the headlines this morning are Obama to announce big plan to control deficit and cut to debt. So,
yeah.
We also have him kind of trying to have it both ways as the defender of all these important things the government does, and the last wall against these cuts, and then to also say, well, but I'm going to be the guy that saves us from debt. And I guess he just wants to be Bill Clinton, right? Which who wouldn't at this point? But that's a bit hard to do.
Yeah, it is. That, I guess, was the main image in my head on Friday. Not the image of Bill Clinton during the shutdown, thank goodness, but of Bill Clinton in negotiations, because I couldn't imagine him being in the same position that Obama was in and coming out with the same result. Clinton was just, for all of his faults, a master negotiator. And that was what used to just eat at Gingrich more than anything, is he would walk into the Oval Office and leave having handed over everything because he felt like he was just charmed out of it. But Clinton, to be fair, kind of did benefit from Gingrich himself. And, that was a big part of why people blamed the shutdown on Republicans, is you had this handy cast of characters who were kind of bigger than life and used to huff and puff. And the narrative, maybe this takes us to our next topic, of last week was this is a test of, how much sway the Tea Party has over the congressional Republican leadership, and the idea that the Tea Party members now are the kind of crazy rabble-rousers who are pushing for extreme things like shutting the entire government down. And I think that's slightly harder just because the Tea Party is this kind of amorphous movement without necessarily a face to attach to it. Maybe Michelle Bachmann is becoming more and more the face of that. Yeah. But it's harder to blame things on them than it was when you had Gingrich out in front. I mean, Boehner's obviously not the voice of the Tea Party. But I know this is not one of your favorite topics. How well do you think last week was a test of the Tea Party's influence? Or is this just, you know, an issue that's been not surprisingly overblown in the media?
I think that the Tea Party provides a handy way for people who are writing the same story again of budget battle, the same story again of, you know, party discipline and discipline on the Hill. The sort of Tea Party lens provides a way to tell it that feels a little bit fresh, that feels a little bit different. And I know that I certainly feel that temptation. You know, when something that seems a little different or a little interesting happens in politics now, I want to say, oh, maybe it's the Tea Party. You know, it's this new thing. It's the Tea Parties. And of course, I work for a libertarian magazine, so we have mixed feelings about the Tea Party. So on the one hand, it's sort of fantastic and heartening to see a mass of people out there who seem to at least, I won't say it's a, you know, subtle understanding of federal budgeting and, you know, global economics, but they seem to sort of get the, we are spending too much money, we need to spend less money or bring more money in, of course, or else the two columns aren't going to balance up. And that's something that I think, as a general matter, large groups of people on the mall don't get and don't talk about. So the fact that there is this group of people who seems to care about that is exciting. On the other hand, I have this feeling that the Tea Party is constantly kind of poised on the edge of populist, social conservative disaster. That just at any time, the dynamic could shift slightly, and then it's just like, you know, border walls and, you know, get your government hands off my Medicare and it's all over. I think when we see a fight like this, which is explicitly about budgeting, and we do see people, at least rhetorically, pandering to this Tea Party crowd. I mean, you know, today we have Bonner saying, today billions, tomorrow trillions, you know, and I don't think that's something that Republicans sort of, you know, run of the mill leadership Republicans would have said a couple of years ago. I think that kind of rabble rousing budget rhetoric, if that isn't a contradiction in terms, is absolutely the result of the Tea Party and something that's, to me, you know, heartening as a strain in American politics. At the same time, that debate is not, the Tea Party is not participating in or producing the kind of actual sophisticated, you know, budgetary math that just needs to be done, that somebody has to do, and that really people in power who know what they're talking about have to do. So whether in the end it actually produces more fiscal discipline, I think, is a big question mark.
Well, it's certainly not something you would have heard Republican leaders saying a few years ago, because they didn't seem to care about these issues when Bush was in the White House. Should a Republican take back the White House in 2012, wonder how quickly all of this goes away.
I do not wonder. I know. It goes away immediately. This is the sad fate of, every sort of libertarian-friendly twitch in the Republican Party. As soon as Republicans come back into power, it's executive privilege and, you know, fiscal mismanagement and it's all
sky is the limit.
Yeah. But then that is a deeply pessimistic view. So maybe I'm wrong, but
yeah, it's so cynical, Catherine.
For one so young, so cynical for one so young.
Well, I wonder, we hadn't planned on talking about him, but, you mentioned that the Tea Party kind of teeters on the edge of, or between maybe legitimate policy concerns and bringing up issues that haven't been dealt with on a national stage, and complete and utter crankery. And I wonder if Glenn Beck and his Fall from Glory, how, you know, soon it seems, since his big triumph of the rally at the mall, how much he's a cautionary tale of going over the edge on that side.
You know, I have to say, as a and not a particularly close Beck watcher, I was taken by surprise. I mean, I knew that his ratings were falling and falling dramatically, but that they were still higher than virtually anything else on cable news, which makes me think that he had a sort of, you know, there's a parallel to the Olbermann situation, right? I think he was a crazy jerk. I think that that really matters more than you know, outsiders might think when you look at the dynamics of kind of who gets the prime time on a television station or who gets coverage. I think, you know, everybody likes a showboater, but there's a point where people become too hard to work with or too hard to understand, frankly. I mean, you know, I think in his later later days, Beck started to, his webs started to spin out maybe a little too far even for people who were sympathetic to him. But maybe that's not true. As I say, I'm not a super regular watcher. To be honest, I tend to get a lot of my Beck from Jon Stewart, which is probably not giving the man fair shakes.
Right.
But, you know, I think that, you know, this whole Trump birther stuff that's happening now, and the fact that there are these sort of conspiratorial ideas that keep popping up, and that Beck really fueled them, you know, that points to the fact that there was something always, you know, to repeat the word again, kind of teetering about him. Mm-hmm. He was always a bit on the edge, and the crying, and of course, was part of the stereotype. But I think in a way, the Beck story is less about the rise and fall of the power of the Tea Party, and more just a weird, sort of bizarro right-wing version of what happened with Olbermann, where he just got too big too fast, went too far, ticked off the wrong people, and imploded.
Right. Well, I think he was always kind of crazy and a jerk, and I kind of had the impression that Beck in the last few months was no different than what Beck had been saying for the last few years. But again, like you, I get much of my Beck coverage from Jon Stewart. So it's not as if I was listening to him every day. But I wonder if this isn't an instance of the left actually managing to accomplish something in terms of getting advertisers to boycott. And it may not have been a very tough sell, considering his performances, and maybe it was just a matter of advertisers who hadn't really been paying attention to him but thought, well, he gets good numbers, so, you know, we'll put our ads on, realizing what this guy was saying and being uncomfortable having their products associated with it. But it was also a concerted effort. I was following mostly on the religious side that after Beck went after progressives for caring about the social gospel, which kind of expanded to all of Catholicism and a large chunk of Protestantism, a pretty large coalition of religious leaders called for a boycott of the show, both among viewers and among advertisers. And they haven't been really successful in accomplishing anything that required sheer numbers in decades and decades, but this is maybe a scalp that they can claim for themselves.
Yeah. Well, and there was one, you know, character that Beck kind of glommed onto that I happened to know about because I'd written a piece about him years ago, Jim Wallace, who's, I think his book was called God's Democrat or something like that, his more recent book. And he, you know, I think he is an example of a religious leader who, who does have, you know, if the conditions are right, this kind of, this ability to motivate a chunk of people to do something. And it can't be something huge necessarily, but but something like, don't watch that program anymore, you know, just change the channel, is a relatively small sacrifice to ask of people. And it is the sort of thing that religious leaders, I think, are able to do. And of course, we see that also with your various, you often see church officials getting involved in when there are rating systems proposed for violent or profane television, that's another place where, or for movies, that's another place where, we as a nation sort of seem comfortable with religious leaders having a say. And I wonder if it's just that Glenn Beck started to feel like South Park. You know, there was a point where there was a convergence of those two things. And as with, I actually think, is this right that Tipper Gore was, South Park was one of her targets, or do I have my timeline wrong? I can't remember now.
I think the timeline's a little off there.
Yeah, I think South Park is later, but whatever it was that she was going after at the time, you know, there is this sort of the left,
the record,
the religious
label,
left,
yeah.
And of course it was the record label too, but so I think that coalition has, already existed and was sort of, they were able to bring that up.
That's a good point, yeah, that this may be one of the, small circles of acceptable influence for religious leaders to get involved with.
Yeah.
Just to go off on a tangent about Wallace for a minute, and then I'll go back to our agenda.
I think he's a fascinating guy. When I interviewed him years ago, and he's just incredibly charismatic in this way that felt to me, at least, very outdated. It somehow felt very 70s, but he continues to be quite powerful, from what I understand, or at least, have some influence.
Well, there's a reason for that, because I've known Jim for a while, not since the 70s, but he has been saying the same thing since the 70s, when he started off as a very young evangelical leader. And it's one of the things I find admirable about him is he has a message and he has stuck with it. It's only in the last decade or so, even barely, that he started to get attention for it. And so this has been an interesting test of what do you do once people actually start listening to your message. And so I just wanted to throw out there that he is starting the third week of fasting in protest of budget cuts. And he, I've been covering this a little bit for Time, that he has now gotten, I think it's up to 30 members of Congress to sign on to fast as well. And I'm kind of surprised it hasn't gotten more attention because it's been a while since we've had a hunger fast in the U.S. on any given topic. And the fact that this is to protest cuts to hunger programs and other anti-poverty programs is pretty interesting.
You'd think if nothing else, the press would go for the tubby congressman fasts for budget cuts. Joe, yes. I mean, like, that's always going to be a winner, right?
Right.
All you need to find
that's
is a fat guy who claims he's not eating, and you've got your story for the day. So, and Wallace, right? He has a kind of compound up on 16th Street. So I guess he's probably holding court from there. I don't know. What else have you kind of heard from the fasters in your coverage? Are they doing real fasts, or are they just doing the, like, fast during the day, eat after sundown thing? Because I always think it's cheap.
Oh, they're not doing that. Although the members of Congress are doing more of a relay thing, where they're fasting until Easter. But, one of them will fast for a day and hand it off to the next. Wallace has been fasting completely. It's just a liquid fast since, I think, 2 weeks ago, Monday. And so he's again going into his third week, and Congressman Tony Hall, who did this in the 90s, again over cuts to hunger programs, is joining him. He's a former congressman from Ohio, and he's been, on a nonstop fast as well. So at the very least, we'll be covering this on Swampland if it doesn't get coverage anywhere else. But let's move into what is fast becoming my favorite topic, just because it's so entertaining and there's not a lot going on the Democratic primary side, which is what the heck is going on with the Republican presidential field, and how did Donald Trump manage to get back into the limelight? And is this all just promo for his show? that's something maybe that has not been sufficiently considered here.
You know, I sort of hope that it's show promo, because if it's all just a cynical kind of publicity play, then, you know, that's just the Trump that we know and love. That's how the world works. You know, all is right with the sun and the moon and the stars. If Trump is actually sort of had some dramatic shift / psychotic break and is suddenly deeply concerned about Obama's birth certificate and Gail Collins' attitude toward him, then we're talking about something different, because, you know, the man does have money and he could easily provide a kind of significant distraction in the discussion about Republican contenders. Now, maybe the Republican Party would be happy with that. Maybe, you know, the more days that Trump dominates the headlines, the fewer days there are where, you know, Pawlenty talks smack about Mitt Romney. I mean, I don't know. Maybe right. That's...
He makes them look more normal in a way that I am convinced normal. That Michelle Bachmann is actually a robot who is created by Sarah Palin's camp to make Sarah Palin look completely rational and presidential.
I actually 100% agree with you. I think that must be true, because that has been the result for me. I mean, I find myself all the time now saying sentences like, yeah, Sarah Palin isn't great, but, you know, she's not crazy. She's just not that smart. I find myself saying things that are based on a Bachmann baseline.
Right.
And the fact that the Bachmann baseline exists and is a real national thing, I think you're right. It must be a robot. The only thing is that then that implies a very, very long-term strategy, because Bachmann has actually been around for a while. I mean, you know, she's no Jim Wallis, but she's been on the scene for longer than a lot of these other kind of Tea Party folks, and has just kind of come to her own more recently. So,
well, that's just what politicians do. You know, Barack Obama planted that birth announcement way back in the 60s, knowing he would run for president someday.
That's a good point. They do have the long view.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if Trump is kind of the male Michelle Bachmann, if Trump is just the guy who's sort of coming to make everyone's haircuts and political views look normal, you know, I guess then he simply provides the disservice of lowering everyone's standards further. But maybe that can't be done. It's possible our standards are already so low for presidential contenders that that Trump is just reinforcing what's already there.
Well, there are a lot of disturbing things about what Donald Trump has been saying and doing lately. And I think one of the most disturbing for me is that it seems as if he has just recently discovered the internet.
Yes.
Because he is constantly in these interviews saying things like, well, I have people telling me that there are serious questions here and, you know, that we really need to look into this. But these aren't advisors who are telling him these things. These are people who write into his website. So they are birthers who are spreading their conspiracy theories, and he is reading them for apparently the first time. Maybe he wasn't around during the 2008 campaign. but he is taking this as seriously as you would the word of somebody you actually know personally. And who you trust. And that's a little scary, particularly, as you say, coming from somebody with that much money and that much of a platform and an ability to influence the conversation. I mean, if this was just Donald Trump who's being a megalomaniac and talking about running for president again for the third time, you know, it'd be nice to think, although maybe this is expecting too much as well, that members of the media, when talking about Trump, would point out that context, that yes, he's talking about running for president, but he has done this twice before and didn't actually end up running, kind of like Newt Gingrich, and just kind of provide that context when reporting. But this whole birther stuff gives a whole new angle to it, because suddenly it's not just Trump might run for president, but Trump, a guy with a lot of money, is adding legitimacy, maybe, to what have been dismissed as just cranky conspiracy theorists.
Although I don't know, I mean, is having Trump on the bandwagon something that
it's
really
not
does
that
add
legitimate.
Legitimacy? I mean, not much. Although it's certainly publicly, right? I mean, regardless of the legitimacy question, you know, the fact is there have now been, you know, an additional 15 column inches in the New York Times on Brooklyn that wouldn't have been there.
And just adds a bullhorn to this that wasn't there before.
Right. The overlay, though, of the apparently longstanding sort of personal grudge match between Gail Collins and Donald Trump is kind of my favorite aspect of it. I mean, you know, the Trump, you know, sort of says, he writes in this letter, and it is a personal attack, and it's, you know, starts with a personal attack and then veers into this crazy birtherism stuff. You know, of course the Times is going to run that. Of course it's fantastic. I do think it suggests that Trump writes his own material. Which I think is always sort of a wonderful thing to find when there are really famous people who could buy the very best in ghostwriting and choose not to because they, as he notes, he is an author of several bestsellers. So
right. I was going to remind you of that.
But then the fact that Collins turns it around and actually really takes the bait and makes it, you know, keeps going with the personal attacks. You know, I've held back for too long. And, you know, he once misspelled the word two and his high rises are visually unattractive or whatever the phrase was that she used. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I think we in the press like to think of the fact that, you know, we like to have this sort of conceit that somehow we're not in direct dialogue with the people that we write about, that there's this kind of detachment. You know, people would say objectivity, of course. Collins is an opinion writer, but still that there's some kind of propriety that exists. And instead, she just like got down in there and she's like pulling on the toupee and, you know, yanking out his, you know, it's just the sort of personal aspect of it is fantastic. And unfortunately, I think for Collins, you know, then undermines her very sort of straightforward, serious treatment of these birther claims. I mean, it would have been much better, I think, for her response to just be, wow, we really need to talk about this birther thing in more detail because it is completely off the rocker and let's not be confused.
It's kind of like watching, we had this happen on Swampland a couple times, somebody like Joe Klein take on commenters. Always tell him, Joe, you're Joe Klein. You don't need to be taking on these cranks in the comment section. But, you know, there's just something to personal attacks and criticism that I think is hard, hard to just let go for a lot of people.
Right. Well, and this has always been Trump's MO, right? I mean, his shows are about taking people who are trying to be professional and running the level of communication down to the bitter personal fight as quickly as possible. So, this is not unforeseen. But I think, you know, when we see these polls that have Trump coming in second, when we see, you know, his name appearing alongside, you know, a list of serious contenders, you know, again, to kind of take refuge in some pop psychology or some psychology that sort of trickled down to the general public, you know, there is this concept of priming people. You know, if you see Trump's name in a group of names, it drags down your view of all of the names, I would think. You know, that if you sort of anchor people on Trump, sure, Romney looks better than Trump, or sure, Mitch Daniels looks better than Trump, but still, the category that they are a part of includes Donald Trump, which can't be good for anyone. So,
Well, let's move on to Romney, since he is at least somebody who may actually run for president and is a legitimate politician. He's obviously been taking a lot of attacks, and this is completely expected from his presumed Republican opponents about RomneyCare and the glee with which the administration has been comparing the health reform he put through in Massachusetts to the national health reform last year. What has his response been, and is it working at all?
I think he's in a ridiculously tough spot. I mean, I've long had a kind of soft spot for Romney slash a sad feeling that he's disappointed me over the years. You know, I sort of liked the Romney who ran for governor of Massachusetts, which whether or not that was the real Romney, I don't think we can ever know. But of course, he took a rightward turn and a turn toward social conservatism as he emerged more on the national scene. So, you know, I always want him somehow to redeem himself for me or to sort of, you know, win my heart back. But Romney Care is obviously a big issue because, frankly, I think the Obama administration is right that, you know, it will be quite ridiculous to have a presidential contest where two proponents of large-scale plans that are very, very similar for healthcare are somehow pretending that they are on opposite sides of a debate when in fact, there is an opposite side of that debate and Romney is nowhere near it.
Right.
I also think Romney Care, so the fate of Romney Care is something of a preview of what's going to happen with Obamacare, among other things. Its popularity has declined tremendously within Massachusetts. It was very, very popular when it first passed and is now much less so. And it's been incredibly expensive. It's been much more expensive than anyone anticipated. And I think we're going to see both of those things with Obamacare. But rather than choosing to make his own plan a cautionary tale, for reasons of pride and probably for reasons of principle as well, Romney is somehow trying to split the difference. And I think that's going to be a bloodbath on the national debate stage if that's the matchup we have.
Right. Well, as you say, it puts him in an incredibly difficult position because, you know, when you're running for something like this, you want it to be able to stand on your accomplishments. And this is one of his major accomplishments as governor. And yet he can't wholeheartedly defend it. And he can't honestly defend it as completely different from the healthcare we saw last year at a national level, which puts him, as you say, in the position of kind of waffling back and forth, which is already his Achilles heel because he is seen as somebody who flips based on what's politically useful for him. And, you know, that's not a narrative that you would have thought going into this campaign cycle he would want to perpetuate, that he needs to nip that in the bud, particularly for Republican primary voters.
Right. On the other hand, though, I mean, I quite like Mitch Daniels. I think he's a pretty smart guy. I agree with his views more than most of the other contenders, but you know, he feels like he's part of this pool of Republicans that kind of bob to the surface every time this discussion starts again. And you know, it's Pawlenty, it's these other guys who somehow never quite break through. And certainly the last cycle showed us that surprise players can break through. But, you know, Mitt continues to have this feeling of inevitability. And I think in the sort of best possible gloss on this, you could say, well, listen, it'll be good for the country to have a discussion of these two different healthcare plans because they can't help but get into the subtleties, right? If you just say that's socialized medicine and Obama says healthcare is a right, people need healthcare, that's as far as the discussion goes. And there's nobody has any incentive to get into any more detail. But if it's Romney Care versus Obamacare, you know, maybe at least it'll get a little wonkier. Maybe at least people will try to see the shades of gray. That appeals to me. Maybe that doesn't appeal to 99.9% of the American public. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. But
yeah. Well, the other issue that I'm waiting to see if it kind of bubbles up to become a national campaign issue is abortion, which kind of took center stage during the shutdown negotiations in a similar way that it did during healthcare. We've now seen it 2 years in a row almost blow up two different big fights. And it's kind of training attention on it in a way that we haven't seen, I would say, in a couple of decades. Certainly we haven't, well, maybe with the blip about partial birth abortion, but that didn't ever really become a presidential campaign issue. But we haven't had kind of a national argument about funding of abortion and where those direct and indirect lines should be drawn since the 80s, really. But that's what the arguments have been about during health reform and then just last week in the fight over whether to defund Planned Parenthood in terms of the federal money that goes to them. And I don't know that this is related at all to what's going on in the states at the same time, which is a lot of state-level bills on abortion, either trying to do things like add 3-day waiting periods, which they've done in South Dakota, and require women to go to pregnancy centers, crisis pregnancy centers, where they'll be counseled not to have abortions before they actually go through with having an abortion, which I think is not at all constitutional, but apparently we'll find out about that. So anyway, there's this trend of a lot of pretty restrictive bills at the state level at the same time that we're seeing Congress again and again turn to the question of whether there is any federal funding of abortion and how. If you were going to, you would eliminate all of that. It just keeps coming up again and again. I don't know what that would look like at a presidential level in the campaigns, but it seems like an issue that is not going away. And while the conventional wisdom is that culture issues tend to become less important when the economy is the main issue, it seems like there's enough momentum behind keeping this on the front burner, that it will make its way into the 2012 contest.
Well, the sort of tricky flip that's happening in the abortion debate now, right, is that the abortion debate is a debate about money, which I think historically it wasn't, although I'm sure this is true of you as well. I feel like I came of age politically when everyone was already completely exhausted of the abortion debate, right? That it just had these little flare-ups, but that as a general matter, you know, I was raised in a good liberal household, abortion should be legal, you know, but it's essentially a settled question. And so it feels, again, sort of weirdly, you know, sort of blast from the past to have this abortion discussion suddenly feeling very, very viable, but instead of a question, sort of a debate about its morality or about its legality overall, we're having this fiscal version of the debate. We're having this version where we fight about whether or not the federal government is going to fund Planned Parenthood or whether, you know, this is a, and of course, I guess during the 90s and early aughts, we did have these discussions about foreign aid and whether money that we sent to other countries could be used to pay for abortions there. But, you know, I think that's the way that this issue stays alive in an election that's all about money, is that it makes abortion about money too. And, you know, I think that probably is it does something of a disservice to the real debate, right? We all know that we're really talking about abortion boo or abortion yay. But the words of the debate are going to be, is it the role of the federal government to fund this activity? And the same thing happened with stem cells, you know, several years ago, that it felt like a debate about, you know, bioengineering boo or bioengineering yay, but it was actually a debate about federal funding of a particular kind of research that otherwise is still not banned, just becomes a lot more difficult and fraught because federal money is everywhere in all aspects of American life. So, you know, I find myself at least a bit torn in those kinds of debates because I often want to say, yeah, why is the federal government, you know, why is there federal money leaking into this moral issue? Why is there federal money all over in life in questions that shouldn't be questions of fiscal discipline? But at the same time, all questions are questions of federal money. That's just a fact on the ground right now. So it's not avoidable. You can't get around it by just saying, oh, we'll take the federal money away and somehow this question will disappear.
Well, maybe I can help you out there because I don't actually think it's a fiscal question. Although I agree with you that I would much prefer if we could just have a candid, honest debate on do we want this or not. That would be both more interesting, but I think also more helpful for Americans. And the problem is that that is too easy because people tend to kind of know where they stand on that. It gets a little murkier, and so it's easier to kind of push your sides. Position when it gets tied up in the question of funding. But I do think it goes back to being a moral issue because what we saw last week was exactly, it was the domestic version of the Mexico City policy that you referred to, which is it ended up being not do we send money to fund abortions overseas. It was do we send money to NGOs who do provide abortions, but our money is for other activities. And that's the same thing going on here, where no federal money goes to Planned Parenthood to cover abortion services. It goes to Planned Parenthood to cover things like birth control and family planning counseling and testing for STDs and sex education. But Planned Parenthood is the biggest provider of abortions in the country, and so the argument is both that money is fungible, which I'll just put on a tangent for a second, that is not an argument you hear from conservatives when it comes to funding, say, faith-based organizations. Then you always hear, oh, of course the money isn't fungible. Of course it's kept separate and completely segregated, and federal money never leeches into allowing an organization to pursue actual sectarian religious activities. But
It's amazing, isn't it? The flexible properties of federal money, how it sometimes can just ooze through cracks without even trying, and other times is a totally discrete solid that you can just set aside and have no trouble. Yeah,
it's amazing.
I certainly agree with you. That argument is always
But that's
used.
The argument that was taking place with Planned Parenthood is we don't care if there are these rules in place that don't allow Planned Parenthood to use federal money for abortions. Planned Parenthood provides abortions, and therefore any money you give to it helps it continue its mission. Although, you know, even conservatives will admit that the actual percentage of Planned Parenthood activities that are focused on abortion services is very, very low, anywhere from 3 to 12%, depending on who you believe. But both sides, and I would argue Planned Parenthood has contributed to this as well, have managed to make that organization stand for abortion in most Americans' minds. And that's because conservatives talk about Planned Parenthood as an abortion factory. And that's because Planned Parenthood people are usually out in the media talking about abortion and the right to choose. You don't often hear them, except when they're put on the defensive, as they have been in the last few months, talking about all of the health services that they provide to women. They're usually promoting abortion rights. And so I don't think it's surprising that most Americans are unaware, maybe, of all of the other activities that Planned Parenthood clinics are involved with, which if you would enumerate them for the average voter would probably be okay with what's going on, maybe even with some federal funding of that. But you're right that this it is at least getting the gloss of a fiscal issue, even though, you know, all of the federal money that is related to abortion services at all is a drop in the bucket. It's not like you're going to save the economy by eliminating all of that. But it takes a moral issue and I think it makes it a little more complicated for people. And muddies the debate so that you don't have to have a, what were you saying, boo or yay for abortion discussion.
It feels like the technique of a high school debater, right? Mm-hmm. You don't stake out a huge moral claim and then defend it. You kind of whittle down your position until you get something that's cleaner and easier to defend. So, you know, Republicans, I think the sort of conventional wisdom, right, is that abortion tends to be a winning issue for Republicans, although it's controversial. people who are pro-life feel more strongly, et cetera, and vote on it. But, you know, rather than tackle the whole big morass of the abortion issue, which you sort of hear the capital letters on, you know, instead to kind of whittle down to this little, totally defensible citadel, in the Republican view of, well, we just don't want taxpayer dollars going to those abortions, feels very appealing as a campaign mm-hmm. issue. It feels very, sort of secure and safe and something that they can just say over and over, without having to get into sort of sticky wicket, you know, theological and moral and ethical discussions. So, you know, I think that making it into a money issue, offers that to Republicans, and then, you know, Democrats just don't have control of how this debate is playing out. So right. they have to kind of follow and respond to the Republican claims.
Right. Well, and so far it is the one interest, that Obama has been willing to completely stand behind. I mean, the reports right. are that he just kept telling Boehner, no, there's no way we're budging on Planned Parenthood. And that's interesting because, you know, just looking at whether it helps Republicans as an issue or Democrats more, you know, in 2004, a third of George Bush's votes came from pro-choice voters, but only a quarter of Kerry's votes came from pro-life voters. So Bush mm-hmm. had the edge in terms of people being willing to cross over right. on the abortion issue. That evened out in 2008, and I think it was back to a third and a third for each candidate were abortion voters who were crossing over. Obama had a third of his votes coming from pro-life voters. And so that is something that, you know, is not going to be talked up, and I'm sure the parties aren't focusing on it the same way they are the battle for white men or for minority voters. But it's something that can move a campaign and is, you know, again, if it becomes a national issue, it can be a wedge issue for people who are motivated. And, you know, again, this may motivate pro-life voters more than pro-choice, although when pro-choice voters feel on the defensive, that is when they tend to vote on it. But we're coming to the end of our time, and we can't let that happen without recognizing the fact that we are coming up to Tax Day on April 15th. As we were discussing before we started our conversation officially, I am about to cut a check to the District of Columbia again, even though for the past few years I have owed nothing to the federal government. Somehow, D.C. always tends to get my money. And this year it's especially painful because in the whole shutdown debate, the White House decided to cede the issue of D.C. and congressional control, which means that not only does Congress get to tell D.C. how to spend federal money, which you can see some argument for, but it's still annoying. But I had forgotten that Congress gets to tell D.C. how to spend D.C. money. So members of Congress are telling our city government how to spend the tax dollars that I'm about to pay to them, which is, I think, even more annoying than usual. So in this case, it means that in this budget, the money for needle exchange programs has been eliminated. School vouchers have to be considered, I believe, as a program for the city. And what was the other program eliminated? Oh, D.C. funding for abortions is now eliminated as well. So that's my little sad rant for next day.
I will happily join you in that rant, as I too am cutting a check to D.C. that boggles the mind. But you know, I think it's sort of funny that you and I would both be peeved by the fact that our D.C. check, you know, the way it's spent is being dictated by Congress, when in fact all of the money that we pay in for all of our taxes is dictated by Congress. It's, you know, it is.
And of course, we have no representative.
And of course, even in states where there is representation and where State budgets are more sacrosanct. Still, on a sort of fundamental level, you know, huge chunks of our paychecks every time, and then, you know, doubly so in April every year, are going to, you know, people who are somewhat but essentially minimally responsive to what we'd actually like to see the money do. And the fact that with DC, that, you know, the debate is about these opportunity scholarships, the school vouchers and needle exchanges, these sort of very, very tiny programs relative to the whole budget, and that, you know, even that is so far from our control as sort of individuals living in the district. Even that is so far out of our hands in terms of influencing how these marginal dollars are spent. You know, that's always my overwhelming sensation on tax day, is just that you're essentially writing the check and throwing it to the winds because what you want doesn't much matter. And you know, that's the nature of government, I guess. But I actually am a little sorry that we took this tax day detour, even though I lobbied for it earlier, because I kind of liked the symmetry of opening the conversation, talking about new babies, closing the conversation with abortion, which that's sort of nice full circle. But regardless, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we can do it again soon, Amy.
I hope so too, and congratulations. I hope you're getting some sleep.
A little bit.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye.